at recording directly onto Spotify for podcasters. So when I've finished, I'll press a couple of buttons and this will go straight up into a podcast, warts and all. Feel free to ask questions and so on. Don't worry, your voice won't come out because of this mic. Then we've got today's topic is purpose. So I'm just reading a book by a guy called Steve Magness. Has anybody heard of him? He's one of these Uber coaches. Yeah, so he really gets the best out of people. I believe he works with athletes. And the book, name of the book is Do Hard Things. And he totally gets it. One of the things that he gets is that, so I'm just talking about resilience right now, your capacity to cope with adversity. One of the things that he gets is this. If you skim the literature or go online, when I say the literature, I mean the popular bookshelf literature. I don't mean the scientific literature. That shows a completely different picture. But if you pick up popular books about resilience or you go online, God help you, on YouTube and get the average of the internet on resilience, they'll say resilience is all about mental toughness, and mental toughness is achieved by going the extra mile and grit and determination and so on. The scientific literature tells us nothing of the sort. And what Steve Magness has done is to identify what it actually consists of. And there's two elements to it. Element number one, let me just see if I can find this quote. Here we go. Real toughness, he says, and this is one of the most best cited books of its sort that I've encountered. Real toughness is living in the nuance and complexity of the environment, bodies, and minds we inhabit. Mindfulness. He doesn't say that, but that's what it is. There's no one standard pathway to inner strength, no formula for making difficult decisions or dealing with the extremes of discomfort. Real toughness is about acceptance of who you are, what you're going through, and the discomfort that often comes with it. It's living in that place of tension so that the needed space can be created to find the best path forward. Okay, so what he's saying there is true mental toughness is dealing with the adversity that arises in your life and the internal consequences of it and the consequences of interacting with others who are also going through the same thing. And that generates uncomfortable feelings, and that is part of life. And so the acceptance of this is a processing of those feelings. Acceptance is allowing yourself to feel whatever you feel in the present moment. It's not some mental gymnastics where you put up with being abused, you put up with intolerable and unacceptable situations because you're tough or any such nonsense, which is the line that we're fed. In the book, he also refers to the strength that comes from having a sense of purpose. Yeah. And so let's look at purpose from the perspective of building resilience. There's a really good book called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, who survived the concentration camps and who identified that the people who survived had a common element, which was a sense of meaning and purpose to their life. Let's look at it another way. Bonnie Ware is a palliative care nurse who journaled the discussions that she had with people who were in the process of passing away. And she wrote a book called The Top 10 Regrets of the Dying. And number one is this: I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself and not the life others expected of me. Yeah. That realization of people, not everybody, obviously, but of the people who had regrets, that was the top one. And so what happens in our culture is that our culture selects a role for us. You have a role as a picks, whatever it is you believe your role is. You're then judged, essentially, on how you equip yourself in the role that the culture has identified that you suit. Nobody ever gets judged on being the best them. Yeah. I know all of your names. You don't get judged on being the best you. You get judged based on an image that's created in people's minds that fits it in with cultural roles. What happens is then we a lot try to align with that. And when that happens, that creates suffering and tension because we can't be ourselves. We can't articulate our feelings openly. There's one thing. We can't articulate our thoughts openly in this world where human interaction is an ideological minefield. And it might not necessarily be that we're just about to say something offensive, but it might be that we're going to say something that doesn't align with other people's expectations of us. So when you add all of this together, what this does is this internalizes our purpose. Our purpose becomes about us fulfilling that role, whatever it might happen to be, all those roles, you know, role within the family, role relation to the workplace, role relation to peers, role relation to the state, authorities, individuals, organizations, all of this kind of stuff. You know, you get a label and that's how you're expected to behave. And so what that does is that's that part of the process of separation. It separates us. So we take a step back. Okay. I was reading a little bit about the evolutionary tree of life. The trunk of the evolutionary tree of life arose 4 billion years ago in the form of microbes that they suspect existed in seawater around volcanic vents. And this process of a bit of matter creating another bit of matter became life. How that arose, who knows? We don't really know. We can't actually create life out of matter. So it's not a simple thing. It's best to leave it in the I don't know category. And then what happened is there's this evolutionary development, and these living beings evolved and mutated and changed. And then you had plants and animals and mammals and birds and reptiles and bacteria and plankton and all of the seemingly infinite insects teeming collaborative living beings that inhabit the planet that then oxygenated it. All the oxygens come from living beings. All the CO2s come from living beings. And this created the atmosphere. And so if you look at this evolutionary tree of life, we are all a leaf on this huge tree of living beings that's so large that if it was a tree, we wouldn't see the end of it. It would disappear way, way into the distance. And then we see our true place in the world. It's an undeniable absolute. And we also see how deeply connected we are. And we're not only connected, we're dependent for our survival, not only on the global family of human beings that supply all of our needs, but also on the global family of living beings, which is what the global family of human beings relies on for their needs. All of the food that we eat and the air that we breathe, and a lot to do with the water we drink as well, is all about this single connected organism. So here's a little story about resilience. Some of you have heard this. Way back in the medieval period, hundreds and hundreds of years ago, not too far from here, a pilgrim's walking along a dirt track and he's on his way to Santiago de Compostela to visit the shrine there. Yes, he's been told to do that because he sinned. So off he goes. And so he's walking along with his horse and it's nothing but mud, pretty much like it often is nowadays. And he's on a very muddy path. And in front of him, he sees two people carrying stones from a big pile of stones on one side of the road, big rocks that a man can just about lift. And they're stacking them up neatly on the other side of the road. And as he walks along with his horse, he encounters the first person. And he says, "What are you doing?" And the guy's red-faced and gritting his teeth. And he says, "I've got to get all these bloody rocks. And it's slippery and I keep slipping down. And look at my hands. And I've got to get them from here and I've got to put them in a pile over there." And so our pilgrim thinks, "Oh, okay then, let's get away before this guy explodes." And he says, "Okay, have a good day. I wish you all the best. You know, I'm on my journey." And then he encounters the second guy, and the second guy, instead of struggling along with the rocks, holding them in his arms, he lifts them up and puts them on his shoulder and walks along with his back straight. And he said, "What are you doing and why are you doing it?" That last guy looked really distressed. And the guy looks him in the eye and says, "I'm building a cathedral." The sense of purpose that comes from doing something and being part of something that's greater than ourselves. That's where resilience comes from. And so if you look at the resilience of people in war zones, people in civil conflicts, people in earthquakes, people in natural disasters, and so on and so forth, what happens is they dispense with their role. If you're looking at a group of people digging with their hands to remove someone from the rubble, they're not a civil engineer, a politician, a builder, a mum, a dad. They're human beings seeking to alleviate the suffering of another human being. And all of the stuff related to their life just goes away. That's how we find resilience. We can find resilience by becoming part of something that's greater than ourselves. And the only thing that everybody will be able to connect with is the sense of being part of the global family of living beings and the global family of human beings. But how do we get from this deeply embedded, highly trained mindset that I am my job, or I am my car, or I am my foreign holidays, or I am some bit of paper, or I am my wealth, or whatever it might happen, or I am how I look, or whatever, to the recognition that we're part of everything, and that our compassion extends to all other living beings. And then that gives us an ultimate sense of purpose, which then makes us resilient to whatever we encounter. How do we do that? And the answer is one meditation at a time. So let's start off with the first one for today, which is a meditation on sound. And that meditation on sound is a meditation on the sound of the bell. And it can be observed as a sound that's moving through time, which is the first step towards connecting us to everyone and everything through the present moment. And if we stick with the ambient sound, which in a busy environment might be traffic and voices and airplanes and movements and continuous hubbub of the city or the countryside, with the wind in the trees and the dogs barking and the bird song, to a place of absolute silence where the only thing that we're aware of is our breath. And then we're meditating on the sound of the breath. The moment that we connect to the experience of the present moment through the breath or through sound, and we notice it moving through time, in that moment, we release our role-based sense of self which we've adopted. And we become very, very small. We become just the sound in the present moment moving through time, and the witness of that sound, or the witness of the belly rising and falling. And And then the role-based mind pulls us into a scenario where we enact the behavior that aligns with our role, which is what we call mind wandering. And then we notice that happening and we step back to notice sound moving through time, the breath moving through time, and then the mind hooks us in again. We're acting out a scenario, mental movie. We notice, back to the breath. And as we practice this over time, we notice quicker. And eventually we notice so quickly that the mind is going to begin wandering, that it doesn't get started. And then all we become is an awareness in the present moment. And this is the mental training to bring us into that experience of living in the nuance and complexity of the environment, bodies, and minds we inhabit. We need to practice this. So we'll just practice it for the next few minutes. It's following sound or following the breath. It doesn't matter how long the mind wanders for. The longer the mind wanders, the more useful your awareness of the mind wandering when it finally happens. Because that mirrors our day, which is a mind wandering experience. And all we're trying to do is to notice, train ourselves to notice that the mind's wandering. We're not trying to stop ourselves from mind wandering. If the pull of the mind is powerful, check in with the body, along with that power will be tension in the body. So refocusing on the eyes, the jaw, the shoulders, the hands, checking in with the posture. Placing the elbows by the side, balancing the head. Placing the tongue against the back of the top teeth, so it's gently in contact with the sharp part of the bottom teeth. And releasing whatever tension you notice with an out-breath. And then only when you're sure that the body's as relaxed as it can be, then we go back to the breath, noticing the tiny little movement of the breath in the belly. All the coolness and warmth. of the breath in the nostrils, or the passage of sound through time. Or any combination thereof, or all three of those things. If the mind continues to be stubbornly resistant to the experience of the present moment, the most popular practice is counting the breaths. We're not causing the breath to happen. We're the observer of the breath. We're just counting however many breaths there happen to be. And the manner of counting is to count one on the in-breath, two on the out-breath, three on the in-breath, four on the out-breath, up to 10. When we reach 10, return to 1. And if we lose count, return to 1. So if you wish, you can move over to this. You can stay with following the breath if you prefer. That's 1 on the in-breath, 2 on the out-breath. 3 on the in-breath, 4 on the out-breath, up to 10. Reach 10, begin at 1, lose count, begin at 1. We call counting the breaths. And now if you allow your mind to be free, check in with your body and your posture. Head balanced comfortably, elbows by the side. Maybe adopting the chin mudra with the first finger and thumb very, very, very gently in contact. Any tension that's arisen, releasing it, beginning with the eyes. Focusing your attention on the center of the eyeballs. Remaining aware of the breath. And allowing the tension in the eyes to drift away with each out-breath. And then the jaw by placing the tongue against the back of the top teeth and leaving it gently in contact with the sharp part of the bottom teeth. You're releasing tension. With the out breath, scanning down mouth and lips, jaw and throat. Breathing in, bringing your attention to the base of the skull, just at the nape of the neck. And breathing out, scanning down both shoulder muscles to where the arms are hanging by your side. And if they're not, place them by your side and allow the weight of the arms to pull the shoulders down. Breathing in, bringing your attention to your wrists, breathing out, scanning down over the palm of the hand, over the fingers to the tips of the fingers. Or from the wrist as we breathe in over the back of the hand, over the fingers to the tips of the fingers. And now breathing in, bringing your attention to the space between the eyes and breathing out like a wave of relaxation, eyes, jaw, shoulders, hands down to the tips of the fingers, down through the body, down through the feet and into the floor. Space between the eyes, eyes, jaw, shoulders, hands, down through your body, down through the feet, into the floor. If your body's balanced, you can allow it to slump. And then back to noticing the breath rising and falling. And as we breathe in, we say the mind rising. And as we breathe out, falling. Rising. Falling. Meditation, which is commonly referred to as noting the breath. From time to time, the mind will wander or thoughts will arise. When we notice that, we acknowledge it, we accept it by saying in the mind, thinking, thinking. And then we return to the breath. Rising, falling, rising, falling. Thoughts arise, or we notice that our mind's wandered. Just needs acknowledgement. That's all it actually needs. There's nothing to be done. Just recognizing the mind wanders or thoughts arise. Saying in the mind, thinking, thinking. Back to the breath, rising, falling, and repeat. This is noting thoughts. And again, allow the mind to be free. Just noticing the ambient sound, whatever it might happen to be, wherever you might happen to be. And following the sound of the bell as it moves through time. Whenever you're ready, gently return your attention to your surroundings. So when the awareness shrinks into the present moment, we all become exactly the same. We're just an awareness and a fraction of a sound. We're not listening to the entire sound of the bell. We're listening to the 300 milliseconds that the brain's aware of as it's noticing the movement of sound through time. So when we do that, there's no space for thought. And when there's no thought, we stop being the list of things that we're supposed to be. And then when that happens, we can connect. So we're connecting through the present moment. We can feel the sense of connection arising as we get more comfortable with that experience at the present moment. It's just a thing and it just happens. And there's all of these meditative traditions who've all got different ways of describing it and explaining it. A lot of it's wrapped up in very complex dogma, which is wrapped up in a whole lot of other stuff. But basically, that's what it all comes down to. So you meet a meditator from the other side of the world who hardly speaks your language and we all have this conversation, and lo and behold, yeah, you've got this sense of connection. And that's what we need to do. We need to come back to being the leaf on the tree and stop being our jobs. Remember your jobs? See, you've forgotten about your jobs. You've forgotten about your roles, your families, do this, do that, got to do this, got to do that, have to be seen like this, bloody blah. That's the power of the present moment, as Eckhart Tolle called it. Okay, so this is the first recording going live with no editing for good or ill.